anti-racism, according to Mokota, was the civil rights movement, and in South Africa, I think we can say the anti-apartheid struggle here as well. And although not exclusively in South Africa, but almost exclusively in America, that movement was again led by the church. Martin Luther King Jr., when he made his I Have a Dream speech, at one stage he sort of just drops his speech and he just talks about scripture. He just quotes Amos and Isaiah, and he's all over the place. It's a sermon that he gives there in Washington. And likewise, Desmond Tutu, Abayas Nodia, it was also a strong movement against anti-racism, and a lot of the rhetoric was informed by that. But the new anti-racist movement that we've seen in the last couple of decades, according to McWhorter, is the first time that we're trying to do this in a secular way. It's the first time that the church is not the guy who's driving it. The church, as a matter of fact, we're trying to play catch-up. So we either banner around Black Lives Matter, or we're a little bit critical, but the point is we're not leading this thing, which to a certain degree is a bit of an indictment against the church, trying to play catch-up, whether it's affirmative or in the negative. But what are the characteristics of this new movement? Again, what I'm saying is not exhaustive, especially in 20 minutes, but I think two of the notable characteristics of the new anti-racism, which I think is part of a bigger drive, and you can include gender and sexuality in this movement as well, is a Marxist approach and a postmodern approach. So what I mean by a Marxist approach is the following. So within Marxism, you traditionally had the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, and you had the struggle between the oppressing capital and the oppressed working class. This is maybe a shorthand, maybe I'm not doing it justice, but I'm sort of tired of apologizing all the time. Is it okay if I don't apologize after every sentence? I'm not doing it justice. All right, just know what I'm saying is not entirely true. How's that? And you've got the oppressor and the oppressed. And then when communism lost a little bit of favor in the Soviet Union, the same framework was used, but it sort of became a little bit detached from just economics. And it was applied to various identity groups. And I'm thinking of the likes of Herbert Marcuse and others who used this framework. And what they basically said is you've got various identity markers, your gender identity, your religious identity, your racial identity, your sexual identity. And in all of those identities, you have oppressors and oppressed, male being the oppressor, female being the oppressed. With race, you have white. With religion, you have Christianity that was sort of in bed with Western colonialism. So Christianity is also seen as an oppressor, Islam and some of the other religions being oppressed. So this is the Marxist background. The postmodern background is a kind of a weird match between postmodernism and Marxism, because if you know anything about these two ideologies, Marxism is very meta-narrative based and postmodernism is very suspicious of meta-narratives. And I think that's why this movement of identity politics sometimes is at odds with each other, especially when it comes to gender identity and sexual identity, because you've got a very strong meta-narrative and then you have postmodernism critiquing meta-narratives. But the postmodern element within the new anti-racism and the new identity politics, I would say, is very suspicious towards anything that is labeled as objective and science and true. And these things are considered in many parts as just words used by the dominant identity group to maintain its privilege. Does that make sense? So when we say this is just scientific fact, when we say this or that, it's just a mirage, a smokescreen, to maintain privilege. Most knowledge is actually culturally constructed according to this view. Now, the Marxist dichotomy of oppressor-oppressed, how it plays out into modern identity politics is, I think, in what is called a common enemy identity politics, as opposed to a common humanity identity politics employed by the church in the previous waves of anti-racism. So Martin Luther King Jr. said famously, "The image of God is universally shared by all men, and there is no greater scale of essential worth. Every human being has etched in his personality the indelible stamp of the Creator. The worth of an individual does not lie in his racial origin or his social position. Human worth lies in his relatedness to God." So you can see the theme of a common humanity very strong. Mandela as well. Many Afrikaners are very, I grew up with Mandela as being this antichrist figure, obviously, and atheist. But he said wonderful things. He said this at Moriah in 1994. "The good news borne by our risen Messiah, who chose not one race, who chose not one country, who chose not one language, who chose not one tribe, who chose all of humanity." So again, the anti-racism approach employed there was constantly, I think, affirming our common humanity. But the shift has been, I think, stark. So with a movement like Black Lives Matter, and I know it's difficult to sort of pinpoint exactly what it is because it's a movement and it's dynamic. But it was interesting at the Pulse nightclub shooting when a guy who was inspired by ISIS went to the Pulse nightclub, it's a gay nightclub, and he massacred, I'm not sure, 50, 60 of the people there. It was interesting to see that Black Lives Matter tweeted immediately afterwards. They said, despite the media's framing of this as a terrorist attack, we are very clear that this terror is completely homegrown, born from an anti-black white supremacy, patriarchy, and homophobia of the conservative right and of those who would use religious extremism as a weapon to gain power for the few and take power from the rest. We need more than vigils and prayers. The enemy is now and has always been the full threat of white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, and militarism. Now, it's interesting to release that tweet, you know, in a time like that, when it's somebody who is sympathetic towards ISIS, he massacres the many of the gay clubbers there, and to say the enemy remains and has always been and remains white supremacy, patriarchy, a bunch of other things, and I think that is anecdotal, but it's part of a bigger base of evidence that suggests that this is more focused on a common enemy. I remember at WITS and at UCT with the Roads Must Fall movement, I continuously saw graffiti that said F, I mean, you can fill in the rest, F, white, hetero, patriarchy. And at the time, I didn't know what it meant, but it was clear that there's a very particular enemy here. So it is more focused on a common enemy approach versus the previous manifestations that's more based on a common humanity. Are you guys with me so far? You don't have to agree. You just have to agree with everything I say. Then I think this differs from the past in a number of ways. One is, remarkably, there was a solidarity in sin that was preached through the civil rights movement, in apartheid, in the anti-racist movements, in the abolitionist movement, which I thought was just remarkable. So, for example, the South African Council of Churches, in 1996, they wrote a little document called The Right of Reconciliation, and they quoted 1 John 1:8, saying, if we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves. And then they go on to name and confess concrete sins of both white perpetrators and black victims, which I think is a very bold move, especially if you consider how things operate today. And Miroslav Volf, who's written extensively on race and reconciliation, he says that Jesus called on oppressors and the oppressed to repent. He doesn't only call the Romans to repent, but also the Jews. And in that context, the Jews were very much oppressed by the Romans. Now, when I say that, I'm not saying that all sins are equal, but I am saying that all are sinners. So there's a massive difference. So I'm not just saying, oh, you killed 500 people, I stole a chappie the other day. We're all sinners. You know, I'm not saying that. But what this solidarity of sin, what it brings, I think, to the discussion is a sort of measuredness, and it bursts the balloons of self-righteousness. Does that make sense? So there's a solidarity in sin when we, and I think it changes the tone of the conversation. And to me, this was evident in the previous manifestations of anti-racism. Okay. Then when it comes to the postmodern element, when it comes to epistemology, what we see in critical race theory, one of its primary formulators is a guy called Richard Delgado, who's, a Harvard law expert. And he developed this point called standpoint theory. And what he said is that oppressed people have special access to knowledge in the way that people who are not oppressed do not have. So when you experience oppression, you can see things that oppressors cannot see. And then this obviously works on an intersectional scale. So if you are black, you can see it. But if you're a black woman, you can see it even more. And if you are a lesbian black woman, you can see it even more because you are being oppressed on multiple levels. Does that make sense? And I think it's no coincidence that the founders of BLM tick all those boxes in terms of multiple layers of oppression. And can I just say that I think, to a certain extent, this is biblical. All right? Why do I say that? Because the Bible said, blessed are the poor. And Jesus constantly warns the rich that they are in trouble. And I think what he's saying is that if you are really dependent, if you are at the mercy of so many forces around you, you become very dependent on God, and I think you've got spiritual insight that other people do not have. So I agree with that. I think that this is actually a spiritual move, at least at first. But if you say that is all, you reduce all knowledge to what is called lived experience, I think you missed the point. Because what happens now is it becomes very difficult to have a conversation, because if I question how a person from a marginalized identity group, how he read a particular situation, then I would just be dismissed as, don't invalidate my lived experience. And look, I think we need to understand experience as something that we need to engage with, and we must do it in humility. But if it becomes unfalsifiable, then I don't think we can have the type of dialogues that we had in the previous anti-racist manifestations. I'm not sure if I'm making sense. So some of the formulators of critical race theory, somebody like Robin DiAngelo, she wrote the book White Fragility. She says, disagreement with critical social justice doctrine is only possible by having failed to engage with it properly. So you see the problem. So if I disagree with it, it's just you haven't educated yourself well enough on these things. That's the only reason why you can be wrong, why you can not agree with us. Can you see how that doesn't necessarily help a healthy dialogue? Barbara Applebaum, who's a critical pedagogy expert, so she looks at learning institutions and how race permeates those institutions. She says, the only legitimate disagreement is to clarify one's understanding. Alison Bailey says, all disagreement is an attempt to preserve one's privilege. Can you understand that if this is the view in which we go to these conversations, it's not really going to be a conversation at all. And I don't think we will be able to have sort of a common ground and try and stretch and figure out, because dialogue seems almost impossible. Barbara Applebaum, as a matter of fact, advises against allowing people from dominant identity groups in classrooms to voice their beliefs, because it comes at great cost to the marginalized students whose experience are being invalidated. So this is called, by Alison Bailey, privilege-preserving epistemic pushback. That's the line. Privilege-preserving epistemic pushback. And again, I think it's dangerous if we say that when I disagree with somebody, that is just privilege-preserving epistemic pushback, that this is just a power play that I'm trying to... are you guys with me? Again, you don't have to agree. I just want to see if the point landed. Michael Harriet writes for The Root. He's also said that when we talk about diversity of thought, it is just a euphemism for white supremacy. Again, this is not very conducive for, I think, dialogue. There's also the hermeneutic of suspicion that is very much part of postmodern ideas, and I think it's moved its way into critical race theory. So Robin DiAngelo, for example, says, the question is not whether racism took place, but rather how racism manifested itself in a particular situation. And the job of the anti-racist is to identify that. Racism must be continually identified, analyzed, and then challenged. Defensiveness or resistance to the anti-racist education is a predictable white pattern that obscures and protects racism. So I don't think, again, that this is conducive for dialogue. And somebody like Jonathan Haidt from New York University says, it's almost reverse cognitive behavioral therapy. So in cognitive behavioral therapy, you train people not to catastrophize everything. But if you train them to see reality through this lens, you are catastrophizing everything. And then any conversation is seen through this lens of, I just need to look for where racism manifests itself in this particular situation. So I don't think that is healthy. In terms of forgiveness, Black Lives Matter has been labeled not your granddaddy's civil rights movement. This movement is angry. So it's trying to distinguish sort of the spirit of this movement with that of its predecessors. And when there was that tragic incident, I'm not sure if you remember, when I think his name was Dylan Booth, this white kid, white supremacist kid, who went to Charleston, South Carolina. He sat in a Bible study with African Americans, stood up afterwards, shot 9 of them, if I'm not mistaken, and then walked out without repenting at all. Directly after that, the families of the victims forgave him in remarkable things. I get shivers just thinking about it. They just said, we forgive that young boy, although he hasn't apologized, although he's very deluded, we forgive that young kid. And Stacey Patton, writing for the Washington Post, said that the article read, Black America should stop forgiving white racists. And in the article, she says, the parade of forgiveness is disconcerting, to say the least. And Tim Keller, the Presbyterian pastor, he wrote an article reflecting on this called The Fading of Forgiveness. And he says the following, that this movement and our culture is secular, but it's borrowed religious terminology. It's borrowed religious language from its Christian past. Things like sin, things like guilt, like shame, all of these words that's very prevalent in our cancel culture are religious words, but it's divorced it from words like grace and forgiveness and redemption. And that might might explain why, and I'm not just referring to the anti-racist rhetoric, I'm referring to the culture as a whole, whether it's on the left or on the right, when we engage these things, I think it's sometimes horrible because there's just this offense archaeology. So when anybody's appointed to a position, somebody goes in that Twitter feed, and if he said something in 1994, 1 year after Twitter, then that archaeology work will be put up on the big screen, and this person will be called to be canceled. And I think it's because they've got this shaming, they do more church discipline than the church, but they don't have the other things that must balance those things, like grace and forgiveness and redemption. And that is why Alan Jacobs says the following about the graceless culture in which we is. He says, when a society rejects the Christian account of who we are, it doesn't become less moralistic, but far more so, because it retains an inchoate sense of justice, but has no means of offering and receiving forgiveness. The great moral crisis of our time is not, as many of my fellow Christians believe, sexual licentiousness, but rather vindictiveness. Social media serve as crack for moralists. There's no high like the high you get from punishing malefactors, but like every addiction, this one suffers from the inexorable law of diminishing returns. The mania for punishment will therefore get worse before it gets better. So friends, in conclusion, I know I said a lot and I didn't really unpack it, but what I do want to get to is the following, that I do think that there are some helpful things that came from this new anti-racism. It exposed some invisible power dynamics that I, at least, was blind to. And if you want to ask me more about it, I can share a bit, because I'm not dismissing it out of hand. But I am concerned about, I think common humanity is a much better approach than a common enemy approach. I think a solidarity in sin makes us more sober, and I don't think it's always helpful to just work with an oppressed category. I think the postmodern principle of lived experience makes it very difficult for us to have dialogue, especially if it's completely inaccessible and unfalsifiable. And also, I think the hermeneutic of suspicion, of looking for racism or patriarchy or homophobia everywhere, has its limits, and I think is at odds at times with the Christian idea of grace and believing the best in something. And then lastly, I would just say that our culture has used all of these religious ideas like original sin and depravity and guilt, but it's divorced it from grace and forgiveness, and I really think we need more of that. And as Martin comes to the front, I wouldn't like to say that I think where it's become a little bit trendy for activism to just be a bit of a trend, I think we need more reconcilers and less activists in our society today. And I'm very much looking forward to Martin debunking everything that I just said.
Okay, thank you very much, Johan, for speaking and sharing your side of the story. I might not have agreed with everything you said, but that is the purpose of us being here, is to kind of work through the various points and approaching this topic myself. It's a fairly complicated thing, and I actually didn't have as much time to pull out all my theory and go through it in detail. But then I also figured with only 20 minutes, that's a good time to share a story about my life and, you know, about my likes and dislikes and that kind of thing. I'm just joking. But anyways, I'd like to just give you, at least the way I'd like to frame my section of the presentation, is I would like to present the story of my life, my experiences with racism, and just kind of try and share a certain side of the story, which I feel that a lot of people, especially our white brethren, might not always be familiar with. So, just to start off, as myself, I was actually born and raised in Kenya, and my parents consequently moved from Kenya to Botswana, and then eventually they moved from Botswana to South Africa, and after that is when I actually then moved here to the University of Pretoria to study study chemistry. And I'm currently doing my master's in medicinal plant sciences, so my life has just been this progressive downward, southward process. And yes, and here I stand, further south in Waterkloof, further south. So one thing that I noticed, though, is that especially coming from Kenya, we don't really have that many white people in Kenya. The only white people we actually have in Kenya tend to be tourists or missionaries. And in my case, the only close experience that I had with white people when I was young and a child was my late uncle was a Catholic priest, and he would often visit with some of the Maltese nuns that he was working with. They often brought sweets, so that was always good. When we moved to South Africa, I think that was the first time that we had to, at least I found myself having to live and coexist with white people as a black person. It was actually very different, I think, for a bit, because my parents kind of told me, you know, white people like anyone else. You know, you don't have to see them any different or think of them as being any different. And my father, who had studied in the United States and in England, had shown me pictures of himself with his white friends and told me these are, you know, he didn't even, the race issue, you know, for us at the time, wasn't really a factor. We would say, okay, you know, there are people like anyone else. And when I moved further south, as I described my southward progression in life, I moved to Bukenote, which is a residence here at Tux, today called House Dau. And it was a mixed residence. There was a lot of white students, a lot of black students. But what was most prevalent was a very strong Afrikaans culture. And as I came in, I was like, well, you know, this is the program. Just have to get along with it. I mean, I was quite used to, you know, not understanding everything that's being said, you know, having been a Kenyan living in South Africa for, I think it was 3 years at the time. So I used to spend time with my white friends and my black friends. I used to see everyone as more or less the same. And what I kind of noticed over time is, well, my white friends and black friends didn't always mix. They didn't always know each other as well as I knew either of them. So I found myself in this odd position of being between both the white crowd and the black crowd, whilst also being inside the white crowd and the black crowd. And what I would often hear from some of my black friends, they would always ask me, like, so what's it like chilling with them? I'm like, brah, they're right there. You can just go chill with them. So for them, and then I started realizing it's not normal. It's not common, rather, to have black people mingling as closely with white people. And granted, it wasn't all sunshine and roses. I mean, there was those people in res who did have certain tendencies race-wise. But it was chilled, you know. I just thought, stay away from the white oaks you don't vibe with, and it's all good, but, you know, all that. Otherwise, I consequently left res, and it was a bit hard for me finding my bearings after that, because in res we have a very strong, like, culture kind of system, things that binds you together, gives you a common purpose, common identity. And once I moved out of that, what we used to call ourselves the Eistermanne, you know, Bukenote, I had to find a new place, a new purpose in life, if you may. I began to grow deeper in my faith and was looking for a more proactive way of following Jesus and walking his footsteps, for which I joined a society on campus called Tux Missions. And the thing about Tux Missions is the reason it drew me to Tux Missions was that there was this missional aspect to it. You know, you have to be outgoing. You have to be out there sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ with people where they are. And so after years in working in Tux Missions, being a member of the society, there was a change on our campus as the various movements, hashtag Roads Must Fall came up, eventually Fees Must Fall. So it was no longer something that was in the distant that you could kind of, there was this kind of, the racial issues were coming much closer, becoming much more vivid. You had to deal with them. And the first thing, my first response to these things were, you know, it seemed chaotic for me personally. In many ways, the kind of rhetoric I was hearing coming from the anti-racist movement, you know, speaking about, you know, whiteness and white people as being, you know, the oppressors and all that, it didn't quite correlate with the experiences that I'd had personally at the time. And it wasn't just a sense of skepticism. In fact, it was more a sense of discontent. I felt that these people were merely communists and, you know, angry people who were just looking for attention. So not only was I unable to interact with them per se, but I had a certain disdain for them. And so, as far as I looked at my personal experiences, I had been on mission trips with white people, often one of the only black people, one or two black people. It didn't bother me as much, at least I convinced myself that it shouldn't bother me as much. I mean, after all, we are all human. And when the movement began, when the Fees Must Fall people, you know, and all their revolutionary yobbery, as I thought of it then, brought an end to our academic studies, and we had to now move off the campus, this was ample time for me to continue with the Lord's work. And so I decided, because they were putting out these posters, you know, the Fees Must Fall people, you know, the gathering of the students, you know, decolonize education. We're going to, you know, revolutionize, we're going to change minds, I was like, okay, fine, you know, I'll follow you to your little lair, and I'll learn what you guys do, and I'll see if I can share some Jesus with you, you know, because that's what I was about. And when I went to these movements, they would have these sessions where they would just talk about their experiences. And what I found was, it wasn't actually something I had dealt with, I was familiar with before. Many times they would speak about their profound feeling of not belonging on the campus, a campus that had been on for the time for about 4 years. They spoke about how there was this kind of cultural dysphoria, a way in which they did not fit in, not just in a discreet way, but more like actively being pushed out. And at the same time, I was also fraternizing with a lot of the security guards on campus because I figured they don't have much else to do now. You know, it's a good chance to evangelize to them. And one thing I noticed, though, is while I was just absorbing all of this, is I got in touch with I kind of learned about the outsourcing movement. Outsourcing Must Fall, as part of the Fees Must Fall movement. And what they were talking about was the fact that the university had been outsourcing, it had been outsourcing and hiring them as like temporary workers without having them as full laborers. Some of them had been working there for almost 30 years. And as soon as they got their rights as university employees, they could actually wear the university crest, university logo on them, and take part in all the benefits. And they were telling me, this is such a profound victory for us. Now we can take care of our families. Now we can, you know, live better. Now we can work with dignity. And I thought to myself, this is 2017, and we have people still talking about the quest for dignity and purpose. And I think that had a very profound impact on me in the sense of this whole thing had been going on that I hadn't been aware of. And so I began to listen more to the way in which race was being used, the way in which race was constantly coming up, not necessarily as an issue of accusation, but as a reflection of pain and suffering. And for a while, I began to think about my own experiences in the places that I had been, and the friends that I had been with. And I began to realize that there were times when engaging with the issue of race wasn't as easy for me as well. I mean, in many cases, I had to try and bypass a lot of the difficulties I had or anything uncomfortable at all that I experienced because I felt, well, that part of me might not vibe with this space. I have this like res lingo that just contaminated my language, so just excuse that. Over time, I started looking at the whole aspect of this race thing from a more academic position, especially considering that I was in my postgraduate studies at the time, and I was always curious. And what I began to realize is there are certain differences that exist in this country, certain things that persist. And the biggest one, at least, was the fact that there was this distinction in land, not the, you know, expropriation of that compensation, but more specifically in terms of how spaces are defined. I found that most of South Africa's economy is actually centered around the urban areas. Urban areas that are traditionally reserved, were traditionally reserved for white people. And while the economic signs had been removed, the political, you know, signs, whites only, had been removed, there were still political hindrances. And so all black people had to do is, yes, access the economic opportunities. But these were also limited in the sense that students were struggling to get through the university system, struggling to get employment. And I began to realize that there is a big distinction between the concept of whiteness and blackness. These are actually tangible terms rather than abstract concepts. And one thing that I looked at least within looking at the concept of why is the word whiteness constantly coming up? If these people who I'd been fraternizing with or getting to know over time were so hateful, why would they use the word whiteness? And I realized that whiteness wasn't necessarily a concept, wasn't necessarily a thing, but rather like a concept, something that's been made up, something that's been, was actually established, if you'd be quite surprised to realize this, around the 17th century. Especially when Europeans were coming into contact with people from other parts of the world, you know, the New World, the Indians, the Africans. And it was used more as a category to exclude, to set aside and say this group is the civilized group, whereas this group is the not so civilized. And in the opposite, obviously, when you consider blackness came up, blackness was seen as being that has to do with less. And I started to realize that this is something which you have to navigate as a black person in a white space. This is something that accumulates as a form of, it's almost like something that you have to contend with, something which is, you may even say, a microaggression. I don't have another word to explain that. And in many ways, I came to realize that it's not that an attack on whiteness is an attack on white people per se, because the concept of white people itself doesn't necessarily exist. It's more a distinction. It's more like a class that was created. But even though it was a class that was created, or an idea that was created, the implications of it are still very real. I gave this example to Johan in our last presentation. I mentioned back in my country, my forebears were living on a piece of land. And one day, a line was drawn. And the one side, one of my forebears was in British East Africa, and the other one was in German East Africa. And eventually, there was a war between the British and the German empires. And at that point, if one of my forebears decided, hey, let me go visit my friend down the road, he'd get shot. Bear in mind that these ideas were created only recently, designations were given to them only recently, but the realization, manifestations of these things in the real world as palpable was dangerous. And that's what you find with the ideas of blackness, in that blackness is not just seen as the kind of thing that, you know, you decide, okay, I'm going to identify as a black person. It's more like, it's something that you have to, it's your being perceived of it, that you recognize, okay, something, part of me here isn't quite being accepted. The struggle for a lot of black people is to express this in words, which is very difficult because the profound feeling of not being accepted for your own humanity, it makes one angry. And that's what I've come to find in many anti-racist movements is it comes out as anger. Anger that you could find in the scriptures, places like Lamentations and the various Psalms, where David is lamenting, complaining, wailing. The cries on the cross, crying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. And the point that I feel here that we have to use, or rather the approach we have to take to such wailing is one of listening, of comforting, of being prepared to listen to this wailing and cry. There's actually a lot of things that I had wanted to say for this presentation, but I realize that the time has run ahead of me, and Johan might be getting a bit, yeah, possibly. But anyways. Okay, all right. But then during our conversation yesterday, I realized that I was getting slightly worked up. We were discussing relatively, you know, everyday issues. And Johan asked me, like, what's your feeling of this? Like, do you find it oppressive? Like, when me as a white person am asking you these questions, when you're having to talk about these things, do you find it oppressive? And the first thing I thought to myself was, you know, the oppression is not something that has to be created. It's something that you're aware of. It's something that you realize. You know, black people didn't need Karl Marx to tell them they were being oppressed. It's something that they were aware of and they've been feeling. And the only thing that kind of reflected the pain and that constant not belongingness is something that was only articulated by the anti-racist movement. And while we often like to say, yes, we have a long Christian history of anti-racism, Martin Luther King, as Johanna just alluded, we often forget that there was also a very strong racist Christian element in the Christian, at least for the most part of the Christian history in Africa, in America. And all I'm saying is that we have to be more cognizant, we have to be more aware of the broader history, of the experience of black people. And if there's one word that I'd just like to say, or rather a statement I'd just like to say around the whole issue of engaging with racism from a Christian position, in the sense is, we are not all sitting in the same place, sadly. And if some of us feel that we don't belong and struggle to articulate that not belongingness, then we might not be speaking the same language. We might not be able to see each other as human, be reconciled as the Church of Christ. And so that's what I was trying to say is, it might sound as though I'm trying to set a new division and say, listen, white people, listen to the people, to the black people, talk, shout, be mad. What I'm actually saying is we have to come together. In order to come together, we need to have this experience, which is sadly mostly being shouted. And from a religion for which Christ had to empty himself to the level of bondservant for the service of humanity and cause us to take on his own properties, his own nature, in service of the people, it's not too tall an ask to have someone just listen more, participate more by listening, learning, and learning as a process through which we can consequently be more reconciled, more united. And this is something that takes time. And I feel like I've best been able to articulate my positions around that. And I really do appreciate that Johan has given me this chance, and that Johan has also been willing to engage in this issue. And I'd like us to continue talking about this. I'd like us to continue just sharing around this topic. And so I think I'll just open now for our discussion, for which Johan has assured me we will be very open. And to emphasize our openness, we're going to chill in the porch here, like hippies.
Questions, we have 10 minutes or so.